Well, it's 10 years ago that we started the first Biz News portfolio, and it's done very well. We've managed to ride a wave of, first of all, the growth in the big tech stocks and then artificial intelligence. But everything has changed. There are possibilities that all those gains could be hit for a six. I'll outline those six issues in just a moment. But to help us to understand where we are and what we need to do about that model portfolio is Piet Viljoen, the founder of ReCM. Piet, lovely to have you, and thank you for giving us this in-depth look at the way the experts are looking at the markets. We like to play on the side. We have our model portfolio. I think you told us to put 2% into Bitcoin. We've got a 10-bagger there. MicroStrategy's gone 10 times in like a year and a half. Now, even the most optimistic investor has to realize that you cannot expect that something that goes from $46 to, over $400 at the moment. Yeah, $400 at the moment. Or Nvidia, Palantir. We've had a fantastic run, but that's been on themes that might have now run their course. And indeed, let me just give you the six reasons that I'm really nervous and why we would like you to just unpack maybe whether we're exaggerating here or perhaps if it is really time to make a radical change to those model portfolios. Number one, Donald Trump and who he's appointing in his new cabinet and major areas in America because it's the biggest economy in the world. It's important. Number two, Elon Musk. He's fantastic, but he's incredibly volatile and doesn't always get things right. Number three, Bitcoin. Got to be telling us something the way that Bitcoin is surging up to almost $100,000 a coin. Number four, potential for World War III. We've had the big flag waved now by Clem Sunter this week. He says, given what Biden did and the reaction from Putin. And last night, we had the Ukrainians sending those missiles into Russia, far behind the front line. World War III, about a 20% chance, Clem says, and he's been waving that flag for a while. Number five, Warren Buffett. He has sold more shares. Selling shares at an unprecedented level. He's got a massive cash pile. He wouldn't be doing that if he saw lots of value in this market. And number six, in South Africa, we have the Government of National Unity, which some people say will last, others say is fragile. Wow. You get hit. If all of those things go wrong, whatever we've built in the last 10 years, our community will just evaporate. So I'm now asking you to help us to just understand the way you see the world right now, especially in the light of those six issues, or perhaps there are others that are influencing your approach.
Look, let me start off by saying that these sort of things, these six items that you mentioned, Trump, Musk, Bitcoin, Buffett, GNU, World War, these things are all fun things to talk about and to speculate as to how they will influence markets. And what will happen if Trump does this or doesn't do that or Musk gets involved. They're fun to talk about and speculate around, but I don't think you can build a portfolio based on your view on these things because your view may or may not be correct. Who knows what Trump will do? Trump himself probably doesn't even know what he's going to do. American presidents aren't the be-all and end-all of what happens in America. There are large constitutional bodies around them which dictate policy. The president can probably tilt it in a direction, but you can't, things aren't going to change radically overnight. The language might, but what actually with the rubber hitting the ground, that those changes take a long time and are slow. So it's fun to talk about, but I don't think you can build your portfolio based on your view on these six. What you can do in terms of building portfolio is to make sure that you have a core of fantastic businesses that you will hold for the long term, however you define those. I have a certain set of criteria which I look at, but we can talk about that a bit later. A core of fantastic business which you'll hold for the long term, and for the long term, I mean the really long term, and you don't react to the ebb and flow of the market with that core of your portfolio. Because if you think back over the past 100 years, we've gone through 2 world wars, a cold war, pandemics, all sorts of things, assassinations. In South Africa, we had apartheid. We had that going away. We had the new inclusive government coming in. All these things at the time seemed like massive events. But if you owned a good business throughout that whole period, it would have done fine. So I think that's the first thing that one has to realize is that these things we like talking about, and I include under that banner things like interest rates and the GDP and all those sort of things and politics. These things we all love talking about and everybody has a view on them, but they actually do not matter that much when you think about it. As long as you own a good business. I mean, look at, for instance, ShopRite over the past 20 years. In a very volatile time in South Africa's history, and a time when the economy didn't grow, the politicians were stealing, and so on and so forth, the business just carried on and grew and served more customers and delighted more customers and made more money for shareholders every year. And that's what you want in the core of your portfolio, as long as those assets are reasonably valued. Now, reasonable is a very wide, broad range. I don't think everything you own has to have a 2 PE. Some of the stuff you own, if it's a good business and goes up to 20 or 25 PE, like in the Merchant West Investments Value Fund, we happen to own Capitec. We think it's on the expensive side of fair value, but it's not crazy. It's not mad. So we continue to own it. So that range in which you just hold a stock is a very wide range of valuation, in my opinion. Those good companies. And then you can tilt your portfolio. Once you've got that core established, you can then tilt your portfolio according to valuation where you see big disconnects happening. And I think the biggest disconnect in global markets that's developed over the past 15 years it's almost 20 years now since the global financial crisis is super low interest rates in the West and a massive buildup of debt as a result of that and a misallocation of capital as a result of that. That, for me, is the biggest dislocation that's sitting there waiting to be corrected over the next 20 years. Because these things, again, they take a long time to play out.
Explain that, if you would, the misallocation of capital and why that's so important and why these super low interest rates would have caused it.
So when you have interest rates that are artificially depressed, like they were in Europe and the U.S., due to the central bank intervention post the financial crisis to save the economy, so to speak. When capital is free, in other words, so very low interest rates mean capital is effectively free. And when you have free capital, capital tends to get misallocated. And I think that's what's been happening gradually over the past 15 to 20 years since the global financial crisis and the suppression of interest rates by Western central banks. If you look at the balance sheets of Western countries, that's most European countries and the USA, you'll find that the debt levels relative to GDP, relative to government income, have just multiplied. They've gone up a lot. So I think that is the big imbalance in the global economy. So then you can think about how does this get fixed? And there's two ways you fix too much debt. You can think of your own position. If the bank phones you up and says, listen, you've got to pay back your debt, your credit card's maxed out, you can either work harder and generate more income to pay back your debt, or you can go and borrow from another bank and pay back that bank. And I think that's what countries have been doing. They've just been borrowing more over time. What countries can do, as opposed to what you and I can do, is they can apply a thing called financial repression, which is something the South African government did in the 80s. So you and I were both around the 80s, and I think many of your community members were around the 80s. Remember, we had inflation rates of 16 to 20% in South Africa, but interest rates were suppressed, repressed, to levels below the inflation rate. And that was done through a system of, first of all, exchange controls, and second of all, prescribed assets. Pension funds and regulated funds had to invest a certain proportion, at one stage it was 50% of the assets, in government bonds. So they were forced buyers of government bonds at interest rates below inflation rates. So that kept a lid on interest rates, which meant that inflation was effectively paying back the debt. The debt was becoming worth less and less over time because inflation was so high. That's what the South African government did in the 80s. And I remember clearly that's when I bought my first car. And the thing then was to buy the most expensive car you could because inflation would pay back your debt. So you borrowed a lot of money to buy this expensive car, and inflation would sort of make the debt less onerous over time. Within 3 or 4 years, you know, it didn't mean very much. Governments can do the same sort of thing. They have already borrowed a lot of money, and they can either pay it back through productivity gains and tightening their belts, which governments never like to do. I don't think any government or very few governments have done that. Alternatively, they can apply financial repression and reduce the debt levels through inflationary means.
That is where we headed. I remember it very well in the 80s, and there's still people who look back on it and say today, oh, you can buy a house. You can never go wrong buying a house. Well, in those days when inflation was, as you say, 15 to 18, and your house, your mortgage bond was 3%, well, clearly it made all the sense in the world to borrow as much as you can. Banks were throwing money at you. But that era that ended in, well, 94. When did it end, or 94. Has it ended?
It ended in 1994 in South Africa. It ended when we had the new democratic government, and all of a sudden sanctions were lifted, and South Africa had access to capital markets, and we had a sensible Reserve Bank policy for a few years and into the late 90s, which reduced inflation, and capital controls have been gradually relaxed since then, up to a point today where we virtually have no capital controls. And also prescribed assets are done away with shortly after the democratic government came into power.
So there's no trigger for financial repression in South Africa, but elsewhere in the world, it does appear to have happened. And does that put us at an advantage in this country, even though short term it might have been a disadvantage?
Yeah, so it puts us an advantage. I think most emerging markets, you will find, have fairly sensible financial positions where the debt as a percent of GDP is not super high. It's quite manageable. Whereas most Western economies, France, the UK, the USA, Canada, have very, very high debt levels of GDP. So and Japan is the other one, of course. Where the odds of financial repression occurring are in those economies who have very high debt levels. It's unlikely to happen in a place like South Africa, which puts investors in a country like South Africa and other emerging markets at a significant advantage. So what's happened is, with their interest rates being suppressed, leading to a misallocation of capital, our interest rates and other emerging markets like Brazil, Mexico, and so on, we've had very high interest rates. So capital has not been misallocated in countries like South Africa. In fact, capital has been constrained. There's been a lack of capital. So the returns on capital are very high, which puts investors prospectively looking forward in a very strong position.
That kind of gets to the core of the whole thing, the allocation of capital in a business, in your business, in my business. Every day, I think in thousands of people who are watching this, in their own businesses, they will be saying, how do I best allocate the minimal resources or the scarce resources that I have? I can't just go out and do everything because somebody is throwing money at me to play. I have to allocate it so I've got a sustainable business. And from what I'm understanding from you now, Pete, that's the same with countries.
Yeah, same with countries. So in South Africa, if you're a business person in South Africa running a company, things have been tight for a long time. I mean, capital has been very expensive. Whether you're borrowing it from a bank or raising it on the equity market, capital has been very expensive. So businesses have been very cautious with how they've allocated capital, by and large. I'm generalizing it, of course, but by and large, businesses have been cautious how they allocated capital, and the returns that they generate in the capital are high, generally speaking. Whereas the converse is true in places like America. Their capital has been free, so it's been misallocated.
So if we then step back and say, look at those BizNews portfolios, which are primarily allocated to stocks in America. And I made mention of them in the outset, a 10-bagger in MicroStrategy, which the investors there are putting a premium of something like $70 billion now on Michael Saylor. Then the Palantir, incredible share price there. I worked the numbers out at a 30% growth rate from here. Their profits, not what they're going to give back to you, their profits would take 21 years to get to the current market cap at a 30% growth rate. And NVIDIA, we know about that as well, although that's growing at much higher at the moment, at 60% being in the at the center of the AI revolution. Are they reflective of this misallocation of capital? And indeed, is the whole stock market in America reflective of that?
And I think it does. It does pull through the stock market. I think valuations, if you look at any business listed company in America and you compare it to that of a similar business in Europe or South Africa or Japan, is rated at a very big premium. And yes, we can talk about American exceptionalism and so on and so forth, but I think a lot of American exceptionalism has to do with basically free capital for a long period of time. So I think the American economy, being a market-based economy that reacts to market prices, is a better environment than many other economies. So yes, it generally leads to better outcomes, but I think the premium you're paying for that more than compensates for that system, which is a good system.
So if I could use a local analogy, a house in Johannesburg that costs 5 million rand or that would sell on the market for 5 million rand, were it in Cape Town, is probably going to cost 10 million rand because the governance
probably a lot more. I think you can buy, in Cape Town, you can buy a one-bedroom apartment for 5 million rand.
Okay, so you're talking maybe 15 million rand. But the point being the governance in Cape Town versus the governance in Johannesburg, real or imagined, is a huge gap between the two. So is there something there that we are seeing now on the international markets? But for instance, let's just use that, take it one step further. But that 5 million rand house in Johannesburg, when it gets to 50 million rand in Cape Town, then it's overdone it. So then it's not worth it anymore. It cannot be worth 50 million rand relative to five. Is that what we're seeing in America? That it's almost like, yes, America does have the best economic system. It does have the capital, but it's also got its problems. So it's not an infinite upward bet.
I think that's a very good analogy. And that's exactly the situation here. Cape Town property is arguably overvalued. And Johannesburg property is, even given the environment, which isn't a great environment, with politicians not doing their jobs there, at some point it just gets too cheap. So if you can buy a house in Johannesburg for 5 million rand and rent it out and earn 15 or 20% yield, that starts looking like a bargain despite the environment. And if you buy a house in Cape Town for 50 million rand, you can rent it out for a 1% yield. That doesn't look like a good investment despite the good environment. So yes, so One has to look in the environment, and the American environment is a great environment. It's a market-based system that reacts to market-based price signals and allocates capital efficiently as a result of that. But the prices more than reflect that good, conducive environment. Whereas places like South Africa, Mexico, Brazil, some of the Asian markets, capital has been tight and the prices more than reflect the tight capital situation and the tough business conditions. The prices are too low even for those conditions.
So when we outlined, or when I gave you those 6 points that were occupying my mind, one of them is Warren Buffett, the Oracle of Omaha, the man who you, through your initiative, have introduced to many, many South Africans. And thank you on behalf of all of us for that, Pete. But the fact that Warren has been selling shares like there's some big problem coming. He's got $160 billion worth of stock that he has sold in the past quarter. Those are eye-watering numbers. Are we not to read something from the Oracle of Omaha?
Look, I mean, not everything Warren Buffett does is a good investment strategy to follow. He has also made mistakes. you also operate, very importantly, under different constraints that you or I would operate under. I mean, his Berkshire Hathaway has, I don't know, I think they've got almost $1 trillion to invest. I mean, so they can only invest in a few things. Their menu of items they can invest in is very limited, whereas you and I have a very, very extensive menu. You know, it's when you walk into these restaurants, they put down the wine list and it's about that thick in front of it. That's what our portfolio's opportunity set looks like. His portfolio set looks like those menus where, you know, you walk in there and there's like three items on the menu. So it's a very different situation, and I'd be hesitant to model my behavior on his behavior at this point because we're on very different situations. But I think at the margin, it is sending a message that he does think that things are overvalued. I mean, most of his selling has taken place in Apple stock. He sold down his Apple stock by, I think, the $150 billion is roughly the number of the past year to date. So I think that tells you what he thinks about the valuation of Apple being one of the Magnificent Seven stocks. It does tell you about that. I think one can read that into it.
All right. So let's go back to MicroStrategy we've put on the one side. You still haven't answered me about that one, and I'm looking forward to your answer there. But Palantir and NVIDIA in particular, I'm being specific because they've come from small percentages to very, very large percentages in the BizNews portfolio, even though on both of them we've sold half along the way.
Okay, let's run through those three stocks. I'll tell you what I know about them, which isn't very much, but I'll give you my impression on them. So first, let's start with the easy one, MicroStrategy. A couple of things there. Number one is, why would you buy MicroStrategy when it's trading at a premium to its holdings of Bitcoin and is run by somebody who has been in trouble with the law more than once over the past 20 years for accounting with malpractice and other things? So I just would not own it. I do own Bitcoin, and I continue to own Bitcoin, and I continue to buy a little bit of Bitcoin every month. But I would not own something like MicroStrategy. There's no ways I would own that. The second one, Palantir, I'm not familiar with the business, so I can't really give you an answer. I know that the multiples are elevated, and it's not something I would be attracted to, but it might just be one of those scalable, fantastic businesses that does very well over the next 30 years. It might be, but I think I did mention yesterday the number of businesses, if you take the outside view, like Michael Mambison says, the outside view is how many businesses have been able to grow at 30% for 20 years. And you'll find there are very, very few businesses that have been able to do that. So what are the odds that Palantir is one of them? Well, I'd say it's very low. I think you're fighting against the odds there. But it might turn out to be fantastic. I don't know it well enough to make an opinion on that. And the last one is NVIDIA. Well, I think any stock that has that amount of hype around it is something that I try to avoid because everybody's in it. Everybody wants it to go up. And, you know, that saying, hell has no fury like a woman scorned. If something goes wrong there somewhere, then there's no price that's almost too low because disappointed people sell on emotion, just like optimistic people or happy people that are in the crowd, that are reacting to the crowd, also buy on emotion. I think so with NVIDIA, you know, when they have like earnings release parties for a stock, it's just, you know, for me, that's just the sign of unbridled optimism. And it's something I'd just naturally be averse to and stay away from.
That's such a good point. I remember when Dimension Data, the South African go-go stock of what was it, the late 90s, was the bell of the ball here. Everybody had Data stock. I attended a number of results parties. They would hire a huge big marquee and have a fantastic dinner. Everybody who was anyone in Joburg would be there. It was a celebration. And I recall at the last one I attended, asking one of the board members, but surely this can't continue indefinitely, 30% growth a year. And I was shot down, not just by him, but everybody else around the table, just for mentioning that. So there's a good memory to remember. You've been following these things more intimately for a long, long time, Pete. Does it remind you right now, and if we start in America, because it's very different to where South Africa's markets are, to anything that you've seen in the past?
You know, there's always a hype stock somewhere. And NVIDIA happens to be the current hype stock. And it's a good business because one also has to remember that hype stocks generally have a good story attached to them. So you can, and anybody can say, well, I own NVIDIA because they're at the forefront of the AI revolution. They make the best chips. Everybody wants their chips and there's a waiting list to buy their chips and their gross, their operating margins are 80%. They're just printing money. So there's a great story around it. But I do think that if you look out longer term, why would the people who are buying these chips, the hyperscalers like Amazon's data centers, Microsoft and others, Meta, why would they not spend a significant portion of their free cash flow trying to develop similar chips themselves instead of paying such high prices to obtain NVIDIA's chips? I mean, you have to think that they are thinking along those lines. So the fact that there's no competition now doesn't mean there won't be competition in 5 years' time, in 10 years' time. And NVIDIA currently is, you know, if you work out how much the earnings have to grow to get it out to reasonable PE, it's by a lot for a long time, long period of time. So again, I think the odds are against you. There is competition, not at the moment, but I am fairly sure there will be over time. I mean, the operating profits and the returns are just so high that it will attract competition. It's not that there are no barriers to entry. It's not that there are super high barriers to entry that are insurmountable. I think if you throw enough money at the problem, you'll be able to design similar sort of chips over time.
The other big thing about investing is that you like to go to bed at night and sleep peacefully and not worry that there might be an event that's going to wipe out a big percentage of your portfolio. And this is what's been occupying my mind as well on the BizNews portfolio. It's a nice problem to have that you've had a fantastic run. But when you think of it that way, how important is that, given that a reverse in these super high-priced stocks could prick a bubble? And, well, you've seen Amazon go down, as I have, 99%. It recovered nicely, but there were many other stocks in the dot-com boom in the year 99 and 2000 that disappeared entirely, but they weren't going to at the time. So I guess that's something I'd love you to just give us your insights on.
So that's quite interesting you mentioned Amazon. I mean, at the time that Amazon was so highly rated, before it went down 99%, it was the online bookseller. That's all it was. It was nothing more than that. And you had pets.com, which is an online pet food seller, and you had all sorts of people selling all sorts of stuff online. And at the time, it wasn't clear that Amazon would be the eventual winner. So when the market crashed, most people sold out of Amazon. Very few people held it through the 99% decline and up through that. And I think that's how you have to look at your portfolio. If NVIDIA goes down by 75% over the next month, do you think you're going to buy more, hold on, or sell? And I have to say that I think most people would sell. And if it's a great business, then you lock in your losses and you don't get back in because now you're upset with the business and you find all sorts of reasons not to buy back in. So, yeah, if you're not sleeping well because your portfolio worries you, then I think that's a very strong signal that you need to do something. I think being able to sleep, a portfolio should put you in a position where you sleep well, doesn't matter what happens. And the only way to do that is to get the valuation on your side. So you don't worry, you know, if markets crash, and you know you own a good business and that business goes down, if markets crash and that business goes down by 20 or 30%, then you're comfortable buying more. I mean, if Microsoft could to halve tomorrow, I'd be buying it. There's no doubt. I'm not sure if NVIDIA did it, I would. But if Microsoft or something like Nestle or Louis Vuitton or one of those companies went down by 30 or 40 or 50%, I would be in there buying because I know that company has a sustainable business and will be around in 20 or 30 years' time, and that is an opportunity to buy more. And so that's, again, getting back to my concept of your core long-term holdings. Those are the businesses you're very comfortable with, and you are at a fairly high degree of certainty that because they've been around for so long, I tell it calls the Lindy effect, the longer something's been around, the more likely it will be around for a long time in the future. The longer something's been around, the more comfortable you are in owning it because you know that they are able to navigate the ups and downs of market cycles.
Do you, as a incidentally, own Berkshire Hathaway right now?
I do. Yeah, I do. It is. I have a core in my asset allocation fund, which I call the cockroach, because it's supposed to thrive when things go well and survive when the nuclear bomb hits, I have a core portfolio of 10, what I call 10 forever stocks, stocks that I'll hold for a very, very long time. And Berkshire Hathaway is one of those.
Are there any South African stocks in your forever portfolio? Or maybe put it differently, do you have South African stocks that you would hold forever?
So in the equity allocation, the bulk of the equity allocations that fund is made up of these core stocks. I have tilted the equity allocation towards emerging markets and South Africa. So a little bit of those stocks, but they're not part of the core holding of stocks that I will hold through thick and thin.
But let's talk South Africa. Let's talk about this country, which in a previous conversation, you said it could be approaching a Lollapalooza effect, i.e. where everything comes together at the right time and it surges asset values surge as a consequence. We don't need to go into the background on that, but what I would like to go through is the South Africa Inc. portfolio and to get your view on what you felt about those stocks in that portfolio. Some of them have been borrowed from you. SabVest, I guess, is one to start off with. If you could give me the insight into why SabVest is such a big holding for you and why it is something that you would continue to hold almost forever.
Yeah, so SabVest is a business investment holding company run by one of the best capital allocators in the country. And I'm not saying that to be complimentary or anything. The track record shows that he is a great capital allocator. The net asset value per share has grown by over 20% per annum for 20 years. I mean, that is a singular achievement. Not very many investors get that right. And he's been able to get that right. So this is an investment holding company run by a superior capital allocator, and it's available at about a 30 to 40% discount to net asset value. So you can buy, what you're doing is you're buying a basket of good businesses run by a good capital allocator who knows when to sell and to buy, sell them and buy something else at a big discount to the intrinsic value. And for me, that is something I would just buy and put away and forget about it, because you know a good job will be done there and you can just hold on to it. And over time, it will, people always worry about the discount to NAV. Why should I buy it? If I buy it at a 30% discount to NAV, I'll never see the intrinsic value. You don't need to see it. It never has to go up to NAV. If the NAV is growing at 20% per annum and the discount stays at 30% per annum, you're earning 20% per annum on your investment. So, I think that speaks for itself.
It sounds to me a little bit like the early years of Berkshire Hathaway, given that it's been going for 60 years now. But if you could have bought into Berkshire Hathaway 20 years in, then in the 80s, you would have been very happy, because that's the kind of return Warren Buffett achieves, 20% a year. And that is the best in the world. So here we have a local guy who's doing it, Christopher Seabrook, but it hasn't been discovered yet, almost, as Buffett wasn't discovered in the early 80s.
Oh, I mean, you have an added complication here is that in South Africa, we're talking about SabVest specifically, but I think what's happened in South Africa generally is that two things. Number one is most investors have taken as much of their money offshore as they can, which means funds that invest locally have seen withdrawals and they have become forced sellers of local assets. And there are no buyers of local assets. So there's no buyers and there are forced sellers because of withdrawal. So due to these technical factors, you get massive pressure on share price over an extended period of time, and they trade at levels which are very well below any sort of sensible intrinsic value as a result of this technical. It's nothing to do with the business. It's nothing to do with how things are going in the economy. It's a technical factor of forced selling with no buying, a lack of buying. So that's one thing that's happening. And the other thing that's happening is that in the unit trust and fund management industry, all sorts of risk managers, discretionary fund managers and others have popped up. And they have effectively corralled all the capital into the hands of three or four large fund managers. 91, Allan Gray, Coronation, because that's safe. You know, if everybody's wrong together, then that's fine, because that's not the problem. So these fund managers become very big in the industry, and they just buy the top 20 or 30 stocks in the market. They are too big to buy stocks like SavVest or anything else below that. So there's no buying interest from the large fund managers for these sort of stocks. So you have these two technical impacts on the market, which has caused anything with a market cap outside of the top 40 stocks in the All-Share Index to be traded far below where they should trade at, which creates opportunity for investors, smaller investors like the Merchant West Investment Value Fund and other niche boutique managers who are able to invest in that part of the market and are able to reap the fruits of doing so, as one can see from the return numbers over the past few years.
And presumably for retail investors as well, individual investors who do their homework, put it away. Just remember that you're buying it forever. You're not buying a stock to get scared or to panic the next time there's a down market. Ride it through. I wanted to ask you about We Buy Cars. I didn't see that in your portfolio now, and I know that this was the reason you were attracted in the first place to Transaction Capital, and then you did sell out of Transaction Capital before the disaster. We didn't. But anyway, We Buy Cars, you know the business well. Is it just overpriced, or is it one that you'd put in a forever kind of category?
No, look, there are very few companies. Sorry, let me rephrase. I'd find it very hard to put a business, any business that's domiciled in a jurisdiction like South Africa, in a forever portfolio because of the political environment, the regulatory environment. It's an emerging market. It's not a stable place. It has institutional risks associated with it outside of the control of the business. I'd rather have my forever stocks in domicile in jurisdictions like the US or Switzerland or Japan or, you know, that sort of place where the institutional environment is set, it doesn't fluctuate, and you know what the rules are, and they don't change from day to day. But that's when you're thinking truly long-term. In South Africa, I think there's a generational opportunity. I'm talking a 5 to 15-year opportunity to buy cheap stocks and to hold them for quite a while. And to let the Lollapalooza effect, if it happens, unwind a bit.
And if it doesn't happen.
Getting back to We Buy Cars, I think it's a fantastic business. It's got great management. I missed it. I should have bought it with the benefit of hindsight. I didn't at the time. I thought the IPO was a bit hyped, and I thought I'd get a better opportunity, and I was mistaken. I didn't, and now it's run, and I don't own it.
The Lollapalooza effect doesn't happen. You're still well positioned in those stocks because the companies are growing fast enough to give you an excellent return. Anyway, the Lollapalooza effect happens, you shoot the lights out.
That's a sort of setup one is always looking for investing. If things go wrong, you don't lose a lot, but if things go right, you make a lot of money. So it's like a cheap option that you're facing in South Africa right now. I mean, if you look at when this offshore-onshore bet started 3 years ago, with one of the business community members who put the money in the value fund, or in my choice of the value fund and Machen's choice of offshore. That was 3 years ago, and things looked pretty dark 3 years ago. They didn't look very good at all. And they have not improved very much by now. I mean, there's a bit of confidence, but the economy hasn't really grown. I mean, you haven't really seen anything change on the ground yet. The share prices are starting to discount something changing. And you can see in the returns of the local funds, you know, it's up almost 30% over that period in a time when, you know, it's been a tough period. And the reason is that these companies are growing by between 8 and 12% a year. And that's what you're getting. So you're getting that growth from these businesses that are used to operating in a tough environment. The management teams know how to maneuver their way through a tough environment. And they are getting it right to serve more customers every year and make a little bit more money for the shareholders every year. And South African businesses are good in that way. They know how to survive a tough environment. And if the environment improves, these managers will shoot the lights out. And that's the upside.
given that you are looking to buy stocks at a good price, at the best possible price, and so We Buy Cars, as you said, it's run too far for you. But if you could, I'm going to read you a list of 12 stocks. If you could tell me if there's anything here that you feel violently opposed to, you don't have to say, yes, I like, I don't like it because it's too expensive. Put that one side. Because I think from a retail investor's perspective, if you buy ShopRite today, you know that in 5 to 10 years' time, with all other things being equal, ShopRite is going to be higher than it is today, because it might be expensive, but it's still going to be continuing to grow. So here's the list. Clicks, Pick and Pay. Pick and Pay is a strange one, but I think it's really with the boxer in mind there, and the Sean Summers factor. ShopRite, Capitec, Lesaka, Lewis, I said I've borrowed from you, SabVest, First Rand, Clientele Life. See how much I've borrowed from you there, Pitt. Anglo American, Sasol, We Buy Cars, Purple Capital, and Discovery, with two possibles on the outside being Argent and Bidcorp. Is there anything in that you would say, whoa, you are on the wrong path here, just watch out, or go and do some more homework?
So I think it's a great list of stocks. There are three stocks I'd probably want to comment on if I could do that. The first one is Anglo American. I think Anglo American are, in the mining industry, probably the worst capital allocators you can find. So if you're looking for a bad capital allocator, Anglo's is your stock. In that sector, I would rather go for something like BHP or Glencore, which are far better at capital allocating capital, own a better mix of businesses. So that's all I would say there. I'd stay away from Anglo American.
So if you had Anglo American in the portfolio because you believe that they would improve their capital allocation, you're taking a bit of a bet there, which is going against history. I get it. Yeah. Okay. Yeah,
and their most recent moves just reinforce that view. You know, trying to get rid of the beers in a down diamond market and so on. So, you know, it's just all the wrong moves at all the wrong times. I mean, Anglo has a history of trying to satisfy the market's short-term requirements the whole time, and that leads to bad long-term outcomes.
Very, very good point, so because the sale, the spin-off of Thungela was a classic example of that. Shareholders lost so much money because of trying to satisfy the market. Thank you, Pitt. Good reminder. Yep.
And then the second one I would highlight here is Sasol. I do think it's undervalued. We own it in the value fund. But I saw yesterday or the day before at the AGM that the chairman said they want to become a leader in the renewables business. Now, if that is going to be their strategy, I would run a mile. So that's something to think about. As I said, we own it in a value fund, but that is a very, very worrying comment. If you own,
thank you.
I mean, they've got this gas to liquids technology, which is a great technology. You can't make chemicals and plastics from renewable energy. Just can't. You can maybe supply some electricity into the grid, but you can't make the products that are necessary for the economy to work from renewables. Just can't. And now they come in, they say they want to become a leader in renewables. It just doesn't make sense.
They've been drinking some Kool-Aid. The Kool-Aid that I was drinking on that one was the Trump Kool-Aid, that he was going to be supportive of businesses like Sasol, not just because of the oil price generally, but because of their huge Lake Charles chemicals plant, which chemicals, being in America,
exactly,
should benefit from his ideas.
It should. But it's the narrative. If I was Sasol, if I was Sasol, I would be on the front foot now explaining to the market why what they do is so important to the economy and why they need to be able to continue doing that. Instead of saying, no, we're going to do renewables. You know? I mean, it's just like nonsense. It's a complete nonsense. Okay. So that's a very worrying factor.
Mm. If they change their approach to that, then it's worth another look. But for the moment, if that's your strategy, it's a dangerous
one. We're in a situation in the value fund where we own Sasol, and now we're looking at this thing saying, you know, what are they going to do? Let's see. We're in a wait-and-see position. And the third one is Bidcorp, you mentioned, which is a great business. But if you're looking for South African exposure, I'd probably want to go for Bidvest, which is more SA exposure. Bidcorp is all offshore. There's very little South African exposure. So those are the only comments I would make. Otherwise, I think that's a very representative portfolio of stocks that reflect the South African economy, with all of them, without exception. There's one exception, Anglo's. With fantastic management teams. And even Anglo's is a fantastic management team. Just the capital, I mean, they execute in the mines well, but the capital allocation is just the problem. All the other businesses, I think, are exceptionally led by the management.
Pete, on behalf of the business community, thank you. Thank you for sharing your wisdom with us. Thank you for giving us your insights, as you always do so freely. I'm really looking forward to getting an update from you, probably before, but definitely at the BizNews conference in March, when you're gonna keep your record for being the only keynote speaker who's spoken at every single one of our events. So I'm looking forward to that as well. And until the next time, I'm Alec Hogg. Piet Viljoen is the founder of RECM and the manager of the Merchant West Value Fund. Until the next time, cheerio.